Welcome to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you missed any of my talk radio breakfast show, don't worry. We've put some of the punchiest bits of this morning's show into a bite-sized podcast, the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. Enjoy.
Let's talk about this in more detail now with the former Director General of the CBI, the Confederation of British Industry, Lord Digby Jones. Good morning to you, Digby.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. What did you make of what Rishi Sunak had to say? Was it, as some people on the Labour side are saying, too little, too late? Was it just right? Or is it actually preserving too many jobs that should go? Where do you stand?
Well, I not only listened to him, but I also then listened to Annalisa Dodds, the Shadow Chancellor. And what I didn't understand about her, I wish they'd take the politics out of this. I wish they'd take the tribalism out of this. And I wish they'd say, look, this is a national crisis. And the one reason it had to happen now was that furlough was ending next week. And I, as you know, chair half a dozen companies, big ones, small ones. And we had this debate last week in nearly all our boardrooms, which was next week we've got furlough ending.
Well, no, it's end of October, not the end of September. But I think the redundancy notices will have to go out at the end of next week.
I'm so sorry. You're right to correct me. We had to make the decision by next week so that redundancy notices could go out and we could comply to make them effective by the end of October when the furlough scheme ends. You're quite right. But the decision, the D-Day for us was next week.
Yeah.
And so we were in a cleft, all of us were, in all our different companies, which was that you'd got people who were on furlough. You're facing two sorts of unemployment. And the nation, and indeed the Western world, is facing two sorts of unemployment. One is demand-driven. It is actually as the economy recovers. And by the way, the economy is recovering at an incredibly quick rate at the moment. It's just that you'll never, ever hear it on various media. You won't hear it from politicians of a different persuasion. You won't read it in newspapers. Why? Because it's good news. But at the end of the day, the economy is coming back. Now, that sort of unemployment will go away. Yeah. People will come into work because it's demand driven. You need the jobs, especially, by the way, in hospitality and whatever. The other sort of unemployment is what I would call structural unemployment, where over the last 6 months, we as employers have learned different ways to do things. And we don't need as many people to do them. And those jobs have gone forever.
Yeah.
Now, that is where government effort should be in the medium to long term. That's why I'm glad he's postponed the budget so that he can think strategically long term as to how he deals with that, announce it next March, because that means retraining, it means relocation, it means different sorts of jobs for people. But the demand-driven one, we had the problem last week where you sit there and think, well, actually, these people are furlough. I don't actually want to make them redundant because I know it's going to come back. But the problem is I haven't got all the work for them now. And so what he did yesterday was first class, because what he did was say, actually, you bring them back for sort of like a third, a bit more than a third. You pay them for that. We'll pay the difference. And then I can tell you now, over the winter, that third will become a half. The government, you and me, the taxpayers' money will go down. And then eventually we'll get to a point next spring where we've kept our workforce that were in demand-driven unemployment.
And this is the key, isn't it? Although, again, it looked like at first that it would be the taxpayer, the government, that would be paying for the extra wages. But then it emerged that the employer would be paying 50% of the wage for a third of the work, and the employee gets 70% of the wages. Again, this is very complicated, folks. The max being paid by the taxpayer is 22%. But again, it still may be the difference between having a job going or not going. But this key thing here is, talking to the small business people yesterday, the message that I got was there is actually a trade-off. There's a cost of, if you're getting rid of people now, there's a cost of making people redundant. You know, there's, you have to pay, say 3 months wages and the like. There's a cost
then.
You lose the skills, but also the cost of then when you do come up, you get the businesses again, you have to then recruit people. That costs money. You're paying agencies and the like. And then you've got to retrain people. So that this may be the difference between, you know, weighing up those costs long-term, getting rid of people or keeping them on.
Spot on. That is absolutely right. People sadly think that employers just say, right, that's 100 out of work. Or whatever. We do not. You know, we do not. These people cost money. They're our assets. They're the best asset we can have. We've trained them. I've always said to small businesses when they go, oh, you train them and they leave you and go and work somewhere else. I say, well, it's better that you actually train them up and they go than you keep them here and you don't skill them up and they stay.
Good point.
So, you know, at the end of the day, we want them to stay and work because we've trained them. And by the way, to pick up the other part of, you know, what does business need out of this week? All these students are moaning about being kept in Scotland. They can't go home. And in England, they've got to stay on their campus. If they hadn't been so selfish at the start of this, if they hadn't started saying when they went back to uni, ah, it's okay, it's granny's disease, it's nothing to do with us, we're going to break the rules, we're going to have our house parties. Well, you're paying the price, girls and boys. And business does not need students to think that they're different to the rest of society. Business cannot afford. And if business can't afford it, jobs go and tax doesn't get paid, which means that you can't build schools and hospitals. Students have a responsibility to society right now to ensure that we can carry on making profit so that we can pay tax and so that granny doesn't die.
Well, again, I'm going to disagree with you on that. And I want people to be responsible. And everyone needs to obey the rules. And just because you're a student doesn't mean you don't have to obey the same rules you and I are obeying, although they are at virtually no risk whatsoever. I mean, we are looking at 124 positive cases at a Glasgow campus, 600 forced to self-isolate. No evidence yet of anybody needing to even go and call 111 or go to their GP, let alone be hospitalised or die. It is the case that someone could have actually been. We see people in the government testing positive for COVID. Are we assuming they've been irresponsible? It may well have been someone who wasn't irresponsible. They may have caught it on the train on the way there and then they passed it to other people. We do it. There's an awful lot of blaming of young people going on at the moment.
No way.
Come on.
No way.
How do you know how it got passed around?
I admire advocacy, Julia, but you're wrong.
Why? How do you know that? How do you know how they got the virus?
I don't care whether they're 19 or 90. If you put 40 people in a room, usually hot and sweaty and all the rest of it.
Oh, they were happy days.
But yes, exactly. As I said it, I thought I can remember that. if you put those in a room, statistically, you'll get coronavirus in it, whether you're 90 or 19.
You won't, so actually. Statistically, you won't,
actually. I'm not attacking them because they're young. I'm attacking them because they're breaking the rules. I don't care how old they are. For instance, you've got certain communities in this country that actually get into houses and have big house parties rather than go to restaurants. And that's exactly the same. You know, I don't care about people's age or the colour of skin or their religion. I couldn't care where they live. I just want them to obey the rules because they're not there to make governments unpopular. They're there so that the country can carry on operating in the way that in your intro you said, you know, we all thought, let's get back to normality.
Yeah, okay.
Well, we're trying hard to do so.
Well, I mean, again, I don't think the government's trying very hard. Let me just ask you, just finally, if we could keep it brief, because I'm over time, but I want to ask you specifically about the pub curfew, the restaurant curfew. 10 p.m. it hit across the country last night. Lots of photographs of people, you know, all out getting public transport together, all being kicked out. A lot of people just going back to people's homes, breaking the rules. Yeah, okay, they're breaking the rules, but, you know, I'm not in a position to police those people. But we're in a bit more of a position to police people when they are out and about, when in licence premises. Do you think that 10 p.m. curfew is a good idea or a bad idea?
From the hospitality point of view, I don't think it actually matters that much in restaurants. I don't think the restaurant industry will suffer at all. I think the pub sector will. And do I think that that will actually do what I've just been going on about, which is getting us back to normality? I'd like to see the stats before I comment. I don't know. Let's see a month's worth of this to see whether it makes a difference. Okay. I have my doubts. For the reasons you just said, I have my doubts. I think you might be right.
Okay.
But I'd like to see a month's stats first.
Yeah, it would be nice if the government had perhaps done some research on it before they made the decision, which apparently they did not do. Always such a pleasure to talk to you. Lord Digby Jones, former Director General of the CBI. Thank you very much indeed.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Talk Radio Breakfast with Julia Hartley Brewer and The Times. Be well informed.
Let's talk to my next guest now. She's a former Economic Secretary of the Treasury and former Culture Secretary and being tipped possibly as a future boss of the BBC. Baroness Nikki Morgan joins us. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Julia.
We may come to the BBC a little bit later. First of all, let's talk about more important things, people's livelihoods and people's lives. Rishi Sunak's jobs plan yesterday, a jobs support scheme, long-awaited criticism from Labour, you know, that they'd waited far too long to hear from it. It was more support for employers and employees, but nothing like what we've seen from the furlough scheme. Just to give an idea in terms of the different scale of help, the furlough scheme has cost £6 billion a month. This scheme will cost £300 million a month, which is a massive pulling away of help for jobs. Do you think he's done enough to stave off huge, huge, huge joblessness?
Well, I think what Rishi's done is to reflect the realities of the situation, both in terms of, as you say, the massive numbers from the furlough scheme, but the fact that we're in a different position from in March. I think people had expected there would be some restrictions, lockdown for a matter of months. And then, as we saw, the economy would hopefully start to recover and people could go back to work. We now know, of course, that it's going to take longer to stop the spread of the virus, to suppress it, and we've got longer to wait until potentially we get a vaccine. And I think Rishi's done the right thing, which is to say we can't carry on paying these eye-watering sums that have implications for all of us, for the future, the taxes we're going to pay, the public debt, the amount that the government is having to borrow. And we know that the economy has been permanently changed by the virus restrictions. We're all living our lives more online, for example. So obviously what's happening in retail and hospitality is changing. There are some sectors that just can't go back to work in the normal way. And he's right to say that actually we do now need to recognise that, to support those jobs where actually hours are still being worked. But to say to employers and to businesses, look, let's work together to realise if some jobs aren't going to be, in his words, viable. Actually, how do we help to transition to new employment? So I think it is right. I don't think it was late. I think it's an unfair criticism because I think we had all hoped that we wouldn't need to impose these new restrictions. Winter would look different. But, you know, this is the situation we are in with this virus.
Indeed, he was very keen to talk about viable jobs and saying he couldn't save every job. But I thought what was really interesting when he said this, our lives can no longer be put on hold. We have spoken so often about this virus in terms of lives lost, but the price our country is paying is wider than that. We need to bear all of those costs in mind. And then later we must learn to live with it and live without fear. That was a strikingly different message and strikingly different tone than from what we've heard from Boris Johnson earlier in the week when he gave his statement to the Commons and his address to the nation, and indeed what we heard from Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance. And we know that in Cabinet there is something of a rift, the likes of Rishi Sunak and the Business Secretary Alex Sharma saying that we really should not be having things like 10 p.m. curfews on pubs and restaurants, shouldn't be telling people to go back and work from home. There is definitely a rift, and we know there's something of a rift brewing in the Conservative Party on the back benches as well over these emergency powers and the route being taken. How dangerous is this for the government to have this division?
Well, I think there's always going to be differences of views between ministers. At the end of the day, you know, depending on the brief that you hold, you know, you are there to represent, obviously, your stakeholders. So, you know, for example, in my former role, Culture Secretary, and Oliver Dowden is doing, you know, a really good job in very difficult circumstances, because a couple of the sectors that he looks after, particularly sports and arts, for example, have been massively affected. And they're the things that make our lives enjoyable. And yet, you know, people want to go back to sporting sports matches and they can't. It's the same with, you know, Alok in business and Rishi in the Treasury. They rightly are saying, well, hang on, these are the messages we're getting from the people we work with. But then the government comes to a collective position, and the cabinet is stronger with people putting forward different views and then coming to a collective view. And I think the role of, you know, Chancellor and Prime Minister, they are different. The Prime Minister has to think about, you know, all of the messaging that he's getting, all of the advice from the scientists, and try to provide that reassuring tone, which I think he did very well in the address on Tuesday night.
In terms of the his lives being put on hold, what do you make of the decision in Scotland to tell students that they have to basically not just self-isolate, but not be allowed to go into bars and pubs and restaurants and in cities to stay on their campus? Basically, many of them isolated to their rooms, and that they can't go home to parents at the weekend, and probably not for Christmas either. We're effectively going to be keeping students prisoner on campuses for the next few months. This information coming out just after students have gone back rather than before, even though a lot of their lectures are going to be online. Perhaps they could have stayed at home anyway. Matt Hancock, the Health Secretary, has refused to rule out this happening in England. What do you make of that policy? Is that even a viable policy in a free country?
Well, I mean, I think that goes to the heart of the debate. And you mentioned that some of my former colleagues on the Conservative benches obviously have misgivings about how the regulations are being passed and the powers of Parliament. I mean, I certainly think it's something that should be subject to public scrutiny and debate. I mean, it's really difficult. I really feel for those students. I'm sitting here in Loughborough. We've got students returning to Loughborough University in the next few days. Many of them are already back. And it's really difficult, again, trying to find that balance between making sure that they get a university experience, that they're living on in halls of residence, that they're able to mix with each other, but also making sure that, as we know, that age group has been, you know, particularly where the virus has been spreading, so that they're not then transferring it to older family members, to people living in the town. It's trying to find that that balance. And I think whether it's long term viable, I'm not sure, but I think it's probably right, particularly when you know, I think it's the case of Aberdeen University, that there is a major outbreak of the virus going on. I suspect that people in the nearby town and city are reassured by the fact that they're not going to have lots of students, you know, in their town while that outbreak's happening.
I mean, I think one can understand that for a few weeks. I think given it's the 24th of September, we've got quite a long way to go to December, telling youngsters, but often perhaps away from home for the very first time in their lives, sorry, you can't see mum and dad until, frankly, when, if you're not allowed home at Christmas? When are they going to go home? Next Easter? For a lot of 18-year-olds, I mean, you know, I'm thinking, you know, some may be delighted. They've got an excuse to carry on partying, they'll think. But actually, I think for an awful lot, this is going to be devastating, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, look, it will be. I think it's a very difficult time to start university. And the you know, any of us who've been there, you know, the freshers week, meeting people, mixing, meeting people, all of that is
mixing.
Really, really...
Is that what we're calling it now?
Say it again?
Mixing. Is that what we're calling it now?
Well, I think mingling is the word, isn't it? Which we're not allowed to do anymore if we happen to bump into friends in a pub or something like that. So, look, I think this whole virus has thrown up the most extraordinary challenges. I'm on a House of Lords committee called Life Beyond COVID. And I have to say, seeing that life beyond COVID at the moment is quite difficult. But I mean, I think there have been some big changes. But the thing we have all realised is we are social beings. We need that social contact. It's the one thing that the virus makes incredibly difficult. And sometimes, as the Prime Minister said, even sounds a death knell for somebody else. And that's why we have to accept these restrictions.
Okay.
But they have to be for a period of time.
Right. Just finally, briefly, you've been tipped as a possible candidate to be the next chair of the BBC. If you did get the job, what changes would you make?
Well, strange enough, I'm not going to do any kind of interview here. Well, I think that the BBC is a fantastic institution. I have no idea who the next chair is going to be. But I do hear the criticism of people who say that actually they're not necessarily getting from the BBC everything that they want. It has to represent all corners of our nation. And I think one of the things the BBC does need to think about is how many people are switching to subscription services over and above watching the BBC. And I think that the moves that Tim Davie, the new Director General, are making to reflect some of that, those criticisms, is absolutely right.
OK, thank you very much.
Talk Radio Breakfast with Julia Hartley-Brewer and The Times. Know your Times.
Right now, let's talk to Labour MP, Shadow Business and Consumer Affairs Minister Lucy Powell, who joins us. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, a very important week this week, very important day yesterday for an awful lot of employers and employees, as we saw the launch of the winter economy plan as it was billed, and specifically the job support scheme. Other measures, of course, in there yesterday announced by the Chancellor Rishi Sunak to help in various businesses and employers. But crucially, we saw this support scheme where we'd see employee working a third of their hours or more, the employer paying a third on top, the government paying a third, employee gets basically paid for more hours than they do, but the employer gets some help from the Chancellor. Do you think these measures go far enough, too far, or are they just right?
Well, I'm pleased that the government and the Chancellor have finally accepted the principle that something more needed to be done once the furlough scheme came to an end to avoid, I think, you know, what could be a large-scale mass redundancies across the economy over coming weeks and months if they hadn't done something. So I welcome that. But I fear that the design of this scheme won't do enough to abate those large-scale redundancies that we might be seeing, because the incentive to the employer is not a particularly good one as designed by this scheme. So the employer would be paying essentially 55% for someone to work a third of their hours, and it would be cheaper for an employer to keep a full-time, say on average wage, one full-time member of staff on, than it would be quite a bit cheaper than to keep two half-time employees on. So, you know, I think, as I say, I'm pleased that they've now accepted the principle that something needed to be done, and that was important for the country and for the tax base, that we keep people in work where we can. But the design of the scheme, I fear, just won't be sufficient to rise to the challenge.
And this is the thing. This is a markedly different level of support that we've seen. At the beginning of the furlough scheme, we were looking, you know, 9-10 million people on that furlough scheme, £6 billion per calendar month cost to the taxpayer. This scheme, we're looking at £300 million cost over each month. I mean, that is the different scale we're looking at. And I, like you, have heard from many particularly smaller employers saying, as you say, I may as well just keep one person on full time and it will be cheaper for me. The only issue there is whether they want to then recruit people in the future and have to train people up and want to keep people on. So it will be a different measure. Do you think this was about Rishi Sunak, whether or not there's game playing going on within government and there is a power battle going on in terms of Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson or not? Who knows? But actually, it was a message to the wider world and to the voters that there is going to be a huge cost to this. And if we're all going to go back into our homes and work from home, and we're all going to go home at 10 p.m. From the pubs and the restaurants, there will be a huge financial and jobs price to pay, which a lot of people don't seem to have quite got to grips with. Do you think that actually we should be paying more attention to the huge economic cost, as he told us to, rather than just to the number of deaths every single day?
Well, look, it's a balance, isn't it? And I think, you know, the government, to be fair, you know, they've been trying to sort of get that balance right. And it's a very difficult balance to get right. I think having really effective test, track and trace, though, it is at the heart of trying to get that balance a bit better. I think the absence of that at the moment has meant that we are having to rely on these ever draconian, blunt tools in order to keep the spread of the virus at bay. You know, that really is a problem, I'm afraid, that the government just hasn't got on top of. And they promised us a world-beating test, track and trace, and that just isn't what we have at the moment. So if it's taking a week or more to get tests back, then obviously that's going to have an impact on people's ability to work and the economy. You know, if there isn't that confidence there in the system, that's going to have a knock-on economic consequence as well. So it is a balance. We've got to get that balance right. But we also have to remember that there are some sectors that are still completely closed altogether. And, you know, our job is to stand behind some of those businesses and jobs to make sure that when we do come out the other side, people have got good, decent work to go back to.
Well, indeed. I mean, again, there's no extra help for a lot of people who are self-employed, or indeed for lots of, you know, the arts world, which is still completely shut down. And indeed, many of those jobs in hospitality and tourism, aviation, travel, that simply are going to disappear right now. Let's focus, though, on the testing figures, the track and trace. £12 billion it's costing us, more than £400 for every single household in this country. And we're looking at only 10% of tests coming back within 24 4 hours. We're told this is a lack of lab capacity and a real massive boost in demand, particularly after children went back to school. But only when people are getting test results back. Now, I've been raising a lot of the concerns of people like Professor Carl Hennigan and others about how reliable these tests are and that a huge number of false positives may be involved. The government has yet to rebut this, I have to say. But only 18% of people who are getting a positive test are self-isolating. And of people who are contacted who know someone who's got a positive test, only 11% are self-isolating. Is there any point us spending £12 billion on a track and trace system if so few people are actually taking themselves out of society to protect others? There's only any point having the tests if people are then going to self-isolate. Otherwise, there's no point spending that money at all, is there?
We'll have to look back in time and see whether the money was well spent. But what I personally believe is that if there was a lot of confidence in that system, so tests were turned around really quickly, you weren't being asked to sort of self-isolate just because you couldn't get a test back, which is what is happening in a lot of cases. If the track and trace sort of app and system, you know, you felt was working well, so that it was tracking and tracing the right people, not just somebody who you maybe, you know, sat alongside a car on the road with or something like that, then I think people would adhere to it much, much better. I'm here in Manchester, and we've seen in Manchester over the summer, you know, loads of different mixed messages about what we are able to do, what we aren't able to do, and the loss of confidence in the testing system as well. So we've got to get confidence into the system. Everyone needs to buy into that and be part of it, because at the end of the day, we're only going to be able to combat this virus because everyone's pulling together and everyone is voluntarily going along with what they need to do. But they've got the financial support underpinning that to make sure that they can. Because I think the other thing you're seeing from those figures, and that's definitely the picture here in Greater Manchester, is that lots of people who are contacted by the tracking service are not in a position to self-isolate. They perhaps a taxi driver, work in the restaurant or hotel business or something like that, and they have to go to work in order to get paid. They haven't got the luxury of working from home. They've got dependent children. They've got no safety net there, and they can't afford not to go to work. So we've finally belatedly seen this extra support for people to self-isolate. But again, is that enough?
OK, well, we'll be putting a lot of those questions to our guests throughout the show. Lovely to speak to you, Labour MP, Shadow Business Minister Lucy Powell. Thank you for that. Thanks for listening to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and give me a good review. And don't forget to catch me on the Talk Radio Breakfast Show every weekday from 6:30 until 10.